quarterback. He's up to 20.
No significance at all in the fact that I'm taking off my watch. I'm not going to look at it. It's just a matter of habit.
Acts chapter 20. And we'll read from verse 1, please. The book of Acts. And chapter 20 and verse 1. And after the uproar at Ephesus was ceased, Paul called to him the disciples, embraced them, and departed to go into Macedonia. When he was gone over those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. There he abode 3 months. And when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. That accompanied him into Asia, Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus, Gaius of Derbe and Timotheus, and from Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1. Much easier doing an introduction to Romans than Habakkuk. People can find Romans. Romans chapter 1, verse 1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ. Verse 9. God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request, if by any means now at length I might have a prosperous journey or a happy journey by the will of God to come unto you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to the end you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith of you and me. Now, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come to you, but was hindered previously, that I might have some fruit among you, even as among other Gentiles. Chapter 15. Chapter 15, breaking in halfway through verse 19. Chapter 15, halfway through verse 19. From Jerusalem, round about to Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. But as it's written, to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see. And they that have not heard shall understand, for which cause also I have been greatly hindered from coming to you. But now, having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you, whenever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you. For I trust to see you in my journey, and to be brought on my way by you, if first I be filled with your company. But now I go unto Jerusalem to minister to the saints, that it has pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. Verse 30. I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake, and for the love of the Spirit, that he strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, and that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted of the saints, that I may come to you with joy by the will of God, and may with you be refreshed. And so we purpose reading from the New Testament tonight. It's rather intimidating, daunting task to introduce a letter like that of Paul to the Romans. It is the first letter in our New Testament, not that the order of the letters is inspired, though I've no quarrel with the providential way in which Romans kicks off the collection of New Testament letters. I suppose it's quite natural to put it there, in as much as the book of Acts ends up with Paul in Rome. There was a certain logic in sticking his letter to the Romans immediately after that. It's also, I think, appropriate that it comes at the beginning. It does lay the foundation of Christian truth. It is concerned with the gospel, as we'll see. And there's something appropriate, really, with having it at the beginning. I think of a word in Ezra chapter 6. Let the foundation be solidly laid. If you get that wrong, then the edifice isn't going to stand. And before we get into things like the church, in later letters, we start with the letter to the Romans. 16 chapters, as we have it. Paul, of course, wouldn't have dictated it in chapters. Suppose he broke now and again for a cup of something to drink, but it would have been a connected whole. But the structure of the letter is interesting. It's a kind of, you think I only talk about food and drink, a kind of spiritual sandwich, because the beginning and the end of the letter deal with quite personal matters, and he gives information about his plans and desires. And the front and the back of the letter read like a letter. So if you went down in chapter 1 to about verse 17, and then you picked up the threads in chapter 15 at verse 14 or thereabouts, you could almost put the two bits together and you'd never know that there was anything missing, because it gives every appearance of being a letter. But in fact, there is a lot missing. The main central part of the letter. And the central part of the letter is a little odd in that it doesn't read like a letter at all. It reads like a treatise. It's almost like a sermon. To some extent, you'd say, well, all the letters are like that. Most of them are like that. You start with some personal details, you end with personal details, and you have the main bit in the middle. But this is different. The letter to the Romans is unique. Other letters in the New Testament address specific local needs. So if Paul's writing in the next letter, it wasn't the next letter that he wrote, but the next one in our New Testament, to the Corinthians, he'll say, now concerning the things you wrote to me, and he'll whip through the points, the topics that they've raised. So that's a big letter too, that's 16 chapters as well. But it's different to this. That's where he's addressing their own particular needs. You don't get any of that in Romans. You get a systematic expansion, unfolding of the truth of the gospel. Why we get that, we'll look at in due course. We know who wrote the letter, and it wasn't technically the apostle himself. Chapter 16, verse 22 reveals the identity of the good soul who penned it. His name was Tertius. I suppose literally you would translate that Mr. Third. You just read with me in Acts chapter 20 about Mr. Second. His name was Secundus. In chapter 16 you'll also read about Mr. Fourth. His name is Quartus. It's a fascinating thing. The New Testament talks about Mr. Second, Mr. Third, and Mr. Fourth. It never talks about Mr. First, because, as Paul taught the Colossians, in all things he might have the preeminence. There's only one that's first in the church. But we've got this letter, which technically comes from the pen of Tertius, but of course owes its inspiration to the great apostle, to the Gentiles, as he calls himself in the book, to Paul. And that's why verse 1 of chapter 1 starts with the word, it's Paul writing to the Romans. From the personal bits of the letter, the front and the back, we've got sufficient clues left us by the apostle, I believe, to identify precisely when, where, and why the letter was written. And when we just examine the question why it was written, we'll also find out why he wrote what he wrote. Why, in fact, this letter is unique in being a form of a treatise. So let's get on with it then. When did he write it? He tells us in chapter 15 that he's been busy evangelizing from Jerusalem to Illyricum. Now this is just a bit of geography, and it's intentional for the Romans. He's saying that if you go down to the southeast, I've gone as far as Jerusalem. If you head northwest, I've gone as far as Illyricum. It was a Roman province, Later on it was called Dalmatian, and Paul actually called it that in one of his letters to Timothy. It's the former Yugoslavia area, and Paul's ministry was quite extensive. I suppose he says Jerusalem to Illyricum because Illyricum was the nearest he got to Rome to date. So he's been engaged in missionary activities in that geographical area, but he has never yet preached in Rome. And in chapter 1, he's at pains to tell them that, although he's ready to preach the gospel to them at Rome, he has, to date, failed to make contact with them. Paul, a unique man, raised up of God for a unique task, uniquely equipped and qualified for that. He spoke Greek. He was a Hebrew and spoke Hebrew. He also possessed Roman citizenship. All these things actually come together at a critical stage in his life in Acts 21 and 2. We're not going to go into that. He is a Roman citizen, and as such, he has the freedom of the city, but interestingly, it seems, he has never been there. Certainly, he's never been there as a believer. He's never had any contact with the churches of Rome. I say churches, there's not one church of Rome, like there was in Corinth. There are a group of house churches, which we read about in chapter 16, but that's not our province tonight. Paul, then, hasn't yet been to Rome, but he got to Rome, I've already said, in Acts 28. So that tells you, your first landmark is this. It was written during the period covered by the book of Acts, because by the end of Acts, he gets to Rome, and he hadn't got there when he wrote it. That's clue number one. We know that when you come into halfway through chapter 21, Paul is bound in two chains, and he never leaves the custody of the Romans from that moment on, that is the Roman soldiers, the military, until you come to the end of chapter 28, and he's still there in a hired house, and he's still chained to a soldier. So you can say that Paul could not, he had no freedom. And since the middle of chapter 21, he tells us in chapter 15, I read it to you, that he's about to go to Jerusalem armed with a financial contribution for the poor saints of Jerusalem, which he had extracted by fair means and foul from the churches of Macedonia and Achaia. So the collection, his famous collection, for the poor saints of Judea is now complete. That gives us another clue. Because in the first and second letters to the Corinthians, he talks about that collection, and it most certainly was not complete when he wrote those letters. In fact, he has to give the Corinthians a very firm kick, you can guess where, to prepare them in readiness for making their contribution. They've been quite forthcoming in their promises, but the actual money hasn't been quite so forthcoming, and he stirs them up a bit. Well, all that's behind him now, so we know it's written after the letters to the Corinthians. Well, they were written in Ephesus in Acts chapter 19, so we're pinning it down now. We say it's got to be after chapter 19, and it's got to be before chapter 21, so we've got a good idea where to look, but we'll come to that in a second. That's a suggestion when? Where was it written? Well, there's lots of circumstantial evidence, and it's all found in chapter 16. You have there a list of names of people who are at Rome. Paul's never been there, but he knows a lot of people who are there. No doubt some of them are his colleagues from the past, and others he's met in his many travels. He sent greetings to several. He also tells you some things about the people who are where he is writing. So he talks about Gaius, my host, verse 23 of chapter 16. So we just imagine Paul now, he's in the house of this Gaius, and Tertius is taking down his composition. Gaius, my host. It may be coincidence, but we just file it away as a fact at the moment, that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 14, one of the very few people that he baptized of the Corinthian church was a man by the name of Gaius. You just hold that there for a second. In chapter 16, he talks about others who were with him, Timothy, and the chap called in the chapter 16 here, Sosipater, who will be the character, the name is the same, as we met in Acts chapter 20 when Paul was at Greece. Just hold that again. When we say Greece, I read my authorized Bible, it's a reasonable translation of it, but the word Greece there was the popular name given to the Roman province of Achaia, of which Corinth was the capital, right? So Gaius, if it is the same Gaius, he was baptized at Corinth. The men who were with Paul when he left Greece in Acts chapter 20, their names appear here in chapter 16 of Romans. You also meet a very prominent man in chapter 16 by the name of Erastus, verse 23. He was the chamberlain, treasurer, manager, perhaps, of the city, Paul says. So we know he's in a city, we can certainly claim that. And we've got an Erastus who has a very prominent civic position in the city. When you look at Paul's last letter, 2 Timothy chapter 4 verse 20, you meet an Erastus who abides in Corinth, Paul tells Timothy. Indeed, when the archaeologists did their work in the vicinity of the theatre of Corinth, they came across a pavement with an inscription, a photograph of which I've seen, which refers to the fact that this pavement was donated by the chief clerk of works, whose name was Erastus. The pavement is dated for a century. There's a fair assumption that the Erastus is the same in each of the three cases. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence from the people sending their greetings here that we're talking about a letter that came from Corinth. And then we add to that the lady who was privileged to carry this document. Her name was Phoebe. You meet her in chapter 16, verse 1. She was a minister, or perhaps deaconess, of a church at a place called Centria. Centria was the one port of Corinth. It was about 6 miles to the east of Corinth itself. So, those are the facts, and one would construe from them that this letter was written from Corinth. Now, when you add to the fact that it's at the beginning of Acts chapter 20, which of course comes somewhere between chapters 19 and 21, that Paul leaves Greece to go to Syria. You read about the problems he had and how he had to go back through Macedonia and change his plans. But for our purpose now, all the facts fit, they dovetail together, the jigsaw works, and I think we can say the letter was written during that 3 months when presumably Paul had a little more leisure than normal to compose a treatise of this length and complexity. He's there, he's reaching the end of his third missionary journey. He'd written from Ephesus to Corinth to tell them that he intended to spend the winter with them, 1 Corinthians 16 verse 6. And he left Corinth early in the spring with his eyes on Jerusalem. He wanted to get to Jerusalem by the Pentecost, and this plot that we read about in Acts 20 set him back a bit. And Paul had to change his plans. He went back through Macedonia, and the saints at Philippi were greatly blessed by that, because he spent some time with them, though it did mean he had to miss Ephesus on his way through. The chances are, if I can just speculate, that he writes his letter, 1 Corinthians, sometime in the spring of 57, 2 Corinthians the autumn, Galatians around the winter period sometime, and Romans in the spring of AD 58. The importance of that we might get to. So he's taking, he's cashing in on the opportunity while in Greece to write to the Romans, something he has long wanted to do. It's important just to note on a practical point in going through, you'd never have guessed when you read Romans that he had any problems with the churches of Macedonia or Achaia. The only time he mentions Zechariah is by way of commending the churches for having coughed up the money for the poor saints of Jerusalem. He didn't tell the Romans that he virtually had to have their arms up behind their back to get the money. He doesn't tell them anything about the immorality that was condoned in the church. He doesn't tell them anything about the errors, the doctrinal, quite fundamental doctrinal errors of Galatia that worked him up so much that he didn't have time to thank God for the money he started his letter. You think he didn't know about those things? It's a lovely touch that this man is not going to share with other churches the problems which he's aware in Corinth and Galatia. As I say, he just passes over those things. They're of no interest or relevance to the life of the Roman churches. That's how Paul thought it, isn't it? When he wrote it, where he wrote it, brings us now to the far more difficult question of why he wrote it. More difficult in the sense it's more complex. There are lots of strands to this. Now, before we can tackle it head on, we need to stand back and look at the situation in which Paul was found. We need to understand that. Paul, I thought he's getting on towards 60 now. He's older than me, just about. And he's reached a watershed in his life. That means he's reached a dividing point for those who don't know what a watershed is. I didn't once when I heard a preacher embarrass myself enormously afterwards. But it just means he's reached a key stage in his life. He's been preaching. He says, "I have fully preached the gospel of Christ." And that's a quote from chapter 15, verse 19. He's been in the East, and he's done a spectacular job. No, he hasn't established churches in every little village. But what he has done is leave behind him, in all the key centres, he's left behind him a lampstand. He's left behind him the testimony for Christ. And if you go to Galatia or Macedonia or Achaia or Asia, there's the legacy Paul has left behind him, and he feels that he's accomplished the task. Alexander the Great, conqueror of the world, king of all the world, as he liked to be known, it is said of him, it may be legend, but it's said of him that he wept when he reached India, because there were no more worlds to conquer. Whether that is true of Alexander, I don't know. I'm not a historian, but I do know that Paul was made of that kind of stuff. He was restless. He finished a great task, but he hadn't finished. And he lifts his eyes to other places. It is his policy, his stated policy, not to preach Christ where he's already named. Not to build on someone else's foundation. That's his priority. Now, it doesn't say that he doesn't get involved in churches which already exist, or he wouldn't have written this letter. But it does say that his ambition in life is to pioneer the gospel in places that have not yet been reached for Christ. Now, that's why in 1 Corinthians 3 he says, "I planted, Apollos watered." Paul was not the waterer. He didn't come along behind and build on someone else's foundation. Other people did that, and quite rightly so, he didn't. He's finished in the East, and he lifts his eyes for somewhere else. I have, he says in chapter 15, verse 23, no more place in these regions. That's literally what he said, no more place. But he uses it in a sense of no more opportunity, no more scope. You don't give any place to the devil, he said in Ephesians chapter 4. You don't give him any opportunity. Esau found no place for repentance, the epistle to the Hebrews says. There was no opportunity for him to repent. And what Paul is saying is that he feels now that there's something completed, and there isn't the opportunity that he's had in the past, and so he's looking for fresh fields to take the name of Christ, and his eyes set on the extremity of the west. He looked to Spain. Whether he ever got to Spain, we can't be quite sure, but the probability is that he did. Not during the accident, but later. There was an elder in the Church of Rome. He wrote 95 AD, so he had to live about 40 years after this. And Clement, this elder in the Church of Rome, said about the apostle, after he'd been 7 times in bonds, driven into exile, stoned, preached in the East and the West, and won the noble renown
that was the reward of his faith, having taught righteousness to the whole world, and having reached the farthest bounds of the west. And he bore his testimony before the rulers, departed from the world, and went to that holy place, having been found a notable pattern of patient endurance. That expression, the farthest bounds of the west, was a way of referring to Spain. So Clement, at least, and he's not long after Paul wrote this letter and after Paul was martyred, believed he got there. But Paul, whether he got there or not, and the Bible doesn't say it, Clement, Rome said it, whether Paul got to Spain or not, that was certainly his ambition and his desire, as he states it in this letter. But if he's going to get to Spain, he's going to need help. He's going to need a stepping stone. He's going to need a springboard in the west. And he is aware that in the very capital of the empire, in the west, there were Christian churches. So what more natural that they should come to his attention? But apart from them, forget Spain. He has nursed a keen, earnest desire for many years to go to Rome itself and to see the believers there. Chapter 1, verse 11, chapter 15, verse 23, there's a very powerful word Paul uses to express the fervent desire he had to see them. Now, I believe you can trace his desire to go to Rome to his contact with a very godly couple by the name of Aquila and Priscilla. Acts chapter 18 kicks off where Paul comes in contact with them at Corinth. They're an exceptional couple. They have recently left Rome because Claudius the emperor had decreed that all Jews should leave Rome for very interesting reasons, but we won't bother with those. By the time he writes Romans, that edict has obviously been lifted because they're back there. But they left Rome, and I believe all in the overruling of God, all it was desperately important to us having the epistle to the Romans, I think. They go to Corinth. They make tents like Paul does. They have the same trade, as Luke observes. So they get together and they live together. Now they just come from Rome. I don't know what they talked about when they're making their tents, but I suspect that one of the things they talked about was the progress of the gospel in Rome. They may have been at Rome at a long time. Remember in Acts chapter 2 there were people from Rome on the day of Pentecost when Peter was preaching. There were Jews there from Rome. Maybe they carried the gospel back. I don't know, but there were churches in Rome for many years, and I suspect that Aquila and Priscilla share with Paul a lot of the information about the circumstances in Rome. I find it interesting that in chapter 19 when Paul's at Ephesus, and Aquila and Priscilla have packed their bags from Corinth and moved to Ephesus with him, so 1 Corinthians 16 informs us, that when he is at Ephesus, he first expressed his determination to go to Rome. He told them he was going to Jerusalem, and after that, he said, I must see Rome. And that's chapter 19, verse 21. And so, that also was from a place where he is in close contact with Aquila and Priscilla. He wants to see Rome. He doesn't want to see the Colosseum. He's not going on a sightseeing tour. He's not interested in finding what restaurants they've got. He wants to go to Rome to meet the saints. Chapter 1 and chapter 15, twice over in both, he says, that I might come to you. And in chapter 15, verse 23, he says, I've had this desire for many years. If I'm right, it would have been 5 or 6 years. But he nursed this desire, this ambition, to get to Rome. Although it's his priority in life to pioneer and plant churches where they don't exist, nevertheless, he is wishing to visit Rome because he believes that God's given him the grace, as he puts it, to encourage them and to help them. And he lays great stress at the beginning and end of the letter, as he writes to them, on why he wants to come. But I might impart to you some spiritual gift, he says, that you might be established chapter 1, verse 11. Now, he's carrying material gifts in Jerusalem. I'm not coming to you with material gifts. I want to bring spiritual gifts to you that you might be established. It's interesting that in chapter 16, when he's signing off, in verse 25, he says to him who is able, or who has the power to establish you, to him be glory forever and ever. Paul clearly believed, if you put the two bits together, that God was going to establish them in their faith and was going to do it through him and his planned visit to them. He wants to come and see them, that I might have fruit among you also, he says in chapter 1 and verse 13. I'm ready to preach the gospel at Rome also. So he's prepared to come to Rome because he can be of some spiritual help, he believes, to the believers there, and also in concert with them to preach in Rome. He's not going to stay there. That doesn't fit in with his priority in life. But he's not going to go to Rome and leave it unevangelized. He intends to go there and to preach when he got there. And he's confident, he says in chapter 15, verse 29, that when he comes to them, he will come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. The blessing of Christ will rest upon his labors. And it did, but not quite in the way he expected. We'll see about that in a moment. But although Paul is going to say to these people, I want to come, and I want to encourage and to establish you, he doesn't want them to misunderstand him. It's not just a matter of being tactful and just wanting to be polite. He really believed that they could help him as much as he helped them. And he tells them that. And he tells them that repeatedly. So he will say to them in chapter 1 and verse 12, just to qualify what he said. I'm going to come, he says, and I'm going to have this spiritual gift that you might be established. That is, that we might be mutually encouraged by our faith. Your faith will encourage me, and my faith will encourage you. And as I say, he's not just being polite. He means that. We read in chapter 15 that he desired to be refreshed by them. Later on he was to talk about this man in 2 Timothy chapter 4, Onesiphorus. And he says, I was often refreshed by him. He wasn't ashamed of my shame. He came into the prison and he refreshed me. And he's confident that the saints of Rome will provide that ministry to him. And he has a lovely expression in chapter 15, verse 24, where he talks about being filled with their comfort for a short time. He really is looking forward to meeting them and the boost it's going to give to him in his ministry. Now, having got that as a bit of background, why he wants to visit Rome, we come to why he wrote the letter. And one of the purposes was to inform them of his travel plan, which he does, so I won't be able to tell you what I have, because I got all the information from Rome. He makes it quite clear that all this is subject to the will of God, and yes, it will, because it was, and God's will wasn't quite his. But also, he is outlining his travel plans to prepare them to fit in with them and to be ready for him when he arrives. He's at great pains in chapters 1 and more 15 to stress the reason why he's not been to Rome previously. It's not for want of desire, it's not even want of attempt. I have been, he says, hindered. I have been frustrated in my attempt. Now he says that in chapter 1 verse 13, he says it in chapter 15 verse 22, but he uses different words, all the good with words. I've been restrained in chapter 1. The road's been broken up in front of me. Someone's put some great obstacles in my way. Chapter 15, but it comes to the same thing. Paul had wanted to get there and failed. Now there were a variety of reasons why Paul didn't get to place. It was in Acts 16, it was the Spirit of God who forbade him and his team to go into Asia. So the Spirit can stop him going somewhere. 1 Thessalonians 2:18, it is Satan who hindered us. So Satan can stop him going places. He stopped him going to Thessalonica. God overruled them, of course, because in Satan's activity against Paul, Paul was compelled to write to them instead, and so we've got the lesson. He wouldn't have had it if Satan hadn't put his nose into it. But it's not just the spirit that sometimes stops Paul. Not even the devil, but sometimes his very service. And that's what he's saying to these people. I have been occupied and absorbed with a work in the East. I have been preaching from Jerusalem right through Illyricum. And he explains that to them in chapter 15. He's writing a letter, taking the opportunity to clarify for their sake his interest in them, and to explain that the only reason he hasn't been able to further that interest before is that he's been too busy. But now, he hopes that they'll help him on his way to Spain, that you'll set me forward, as he puts it in chapter 15, verse 24. I intend to go through you, verse 29 says. So he's going to use them as a route to Spain, but not just sort of flying through, but he is hoping that they will provide him with some practical assistance as he springs into the West. So that's another reason, that's one reason he's writing, to encourage their interest in his mission to Spain. A second, a very simple reason, was that this lady, Phoebe, is about to leave Corinth, or Centuria, and go to Rome, and Paul arms her with this letter of commendation. Now, of course, Romans isn't a letter of commendation, it's a great treatise on the gospel. But one of the things he does in the letter, in the beginning of chapter 16, is to give her a word of commendation and to encourage these believers, many of whom he knew personally, so they could accept his testimony, that she should be received. Now, you can see the function of a letter in this situation. Here's a complete stranger turning up in the Roman churches, and she comes out with a document which is signed at the end, not quite written all the way through, but signed at the end by a man who is known personally to many of the leaders in the churches of Rome. That makes sense. Doesn't make so much sense that people demand that you take a letter of commendation when you go to the next assembly down the road where you've been 87 times in the past. They may even have asked you to come and speak, and they'll still demand a letter of commendation. And frankly, I can't see any sense to it. But in this situation, it made sense. And Paul armed her with this. The ways of God are very odd sometimes. Like, I mean, if I'd been consulted on who you trusted to carry one of the most important documents ever written. Right? And she's not carrying it round the corner. She's going to travel 650 miles if the crow flies, and she's not one. And she's going to have to do 1,100 miles sea travel to get to Rome. I don't know if she's got a handbag or not, but whatever she used, this document traveled with that woman. It's strange how the Lord uses this soul sister, his lone sister, to carry this document. Without that document, Augustine wouldn't have been converted, Luther wouldn't have been converted, Wesley wouldn't have been converted, and neither would millions of other people. And that document she carried. And Augustine and Luther and Wesley and thousands and millions of others have every cause to be grateful to that woman and to the God who preserved it on her way. It was a long way. Travel was reasonably easy. It wasn't as hazardous as you might think. They say that travel in the first century was safer than at any time until the last century. There weren't any pirates committed on the Mediterranean. And a Roman writer by the name of Pliny tells you that you could travel from Rome to Spain in 4 days comfortably by ship. You could get to Africa, there's the thought, in 2 days by ship. The Apostle Paul actually got to Rome by a funny route in the end. Sorry, I've gone off on a tangent. He ended up going to Rome via Malta, and it just reminds me of Balkan Airways and the funny routes they follow to get you to Africa. Well, Pliny didn't travel via Malta when he went to Africa. He could do it in 2 days. There was one merchantman, he lived in Hierapolis, in Asia Minor. He's 1,250 miles away from Rome. In the course of his business,
business, he travelled 72 times back and forth to the capital. So his tombs, people put funny things on their tombs. But, well, they don't, other people do. His wife must have done it. But on his tomb, there's this record that he's gone back and forth 72 times. But anyway, this woman, she is entrusted with this document. I wondered how well she looked after it, whether she realised anything of its value. But she secured a place for herself in the Word of God, and there's the name in chapter 15. Paul's writing to tell him about his travel plans and seek their cooperation. He writes, incidentally, to commend his dear lady, and he writes to seek their prayers. We read it at the end of chapter 15. He's worried. He's going to Jerusalem, but he's got a host of problems that await him there. The first is them out there. The non-Christian world, the Jewish non-Christian world, that I may be delivered from them that don't believe in Judea. And his fears were well grounded, as the sequel proved, because when he got to Jerusalem, he'd hardly reached the place a matter of days before he's in chains. And as I say, he never left the chains till he got to Rome, and it was all their fault, and you can read it. It's an exciting story in Acts chapter 21. And the Lord, in a sense, used the hostility of the Jews. Paul wants him to pray that he'd be delivered from the Jews, but the Lord didn't deliver him from the Jews. And the Lord overruled the hostility of the Jews and the intervention of the Romans to give Paul a passage to Rome. I don't know whether he had to contribute to the cost or not. I suspect not. He went in chains. And it was, as I say, an odd route he followed. He had to swim part of the way. Like he says in chapter 1, his prayer was that he might have a happy journey to you by the will of God. Don't know whether he was laughing when he was swimming from the shipwreck and landed on the island of Malta. I didn't find him particularly friendly people when we were there, but then we only stopped at the airport. He did. The barbarians showed us no little kindness, Luke records. They lit the fire and warmed him when he was soaking because it rained. We've gone off on some tangents, haven't we? But the Lord brought him to Rome. Not the way he wanted to go, not the way he planned to go, not the way he prayed to go, but the best way. When Paul looked back on it years later, he recognized this, and he says to the Philippians, there's no need to be concerned that everything's out of control. I want you to know that the things which happened to me have turned out rather to the furtherance of the gospel. You know, he says, the gospel has penetrated places here in Rome that it could never have got if I hadn't come here in chains. The whole Praetorian Guard has heard the gospel here in the prison, which it would not have reached if God hadn't brought me the uncomfortable way he did. But he wants him to pray. At that point in his life, he was concerned, and he asked him to pray for that. But he also asked him to pray, and it sounds a little odd, that his service, the gift, the financial gift he was taking for those of Jerusalem, might be accepted. Now, not many people are in the habit of turning away financial support. But these weren't ordinary people, and the support wasn't ordinary support. They were Jews. You may remember that expression in John's epistle, taking nothing of the Gentiles. Well, that had come to mean something else when John wrote. But originally it meant what it says, that the Jews would just take no support whatever from Gentiles. And these are Gentile churches. And Paul has been beavering away for most of his third missionary journey on this collection thing. And it does raise questions why he attached such importance to it, because he did. 2.5 chapters of your Bible are concerned with it, for that matter. But Paul put a lot of energy into this collection because he saw it fulfilling many needs. He can see its value, not only in terms of the recipients. Obviously, they would be better off. They are the poor saints of Jerusalem. Remember what James said to him in Galatians 2 at Jerusalem at the beginning, not to forget the poor. And Paul says we were only too ready to cooperate with that. And yes, Paul cared about them because they were poor people. And as he said to one of the Roman authorities when he got to Jerusalem, I come with alms for my nation. He brought money because people needed it. They got something out of it. So too did the people who sent it. As he says in chapter 15, I didn't read it to you, in fact I skirted it, it's verse 27. It was a payment of a debt. because it was from the Jews that their spiritual things had been ministered. The gospel, after all, had come from them originally. And it was their duty and obligation to recompense them in material things, he says. So there's something in it for them as well, it's a payment of the debt. There was something in it for the Lord. As he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, all this is going to contribute to an abundance of thanksgiving on the part of the Jewish Christians. And he could see that the Lord was going to have much praise as a result of this. But the key thing for Paul was that this collection would cement relationships between the two sections, as they were in danger of becoming, of the Christian church. You had the Jewish Christians and you had the Gentile Christians. And Paul saw this collection as being the surefire way of achieving a harmony and a unity among them that the Jews were a very arrogant lot in themselves. The Jewish Christians now would warm to the Gentiles when they realized that in their poverty these people, and some of them were equally poor, that they had gone deep into their pockets for their sake. And as he says in chapter 15, verse 28, this collection will be a seal. It will confirm to the saints of Jerusalem the fruit of the gospel among the Gentiles. It would have been an absolute disaster, a tragedy beyond description, if when he got to Jerusalem, the saints said, "You can keep it. We don't want to know." And that's why he says, "I want you to pray for me, that it will be accepted. It matters. It means a lot." Not just because he'd invested time and effort, but because of what it signified of the well-being of the Christian church. We don't know how much actually we owe to that collection. What the church would have been like if there had been two segments, Jew and Gentile, separate, and how much this collection contributed to the unity of the two paths. But Paul is writing. Tell them what he wants to do in Spain, and will you help me? To commend this lady, to ask their prayers for him. And last of all, he is taking the opportunity to expound his gospel. I called it that in the office on Monday morning when talking to a Christian. He was quite horrified. He thought, he said, "I'm a Paul, I'm Apollos." I assured him that in this letter, twice over, Paul calls it my gospel.
Reasons
we may touch on. He's going in this letter to set out the fundamental principles of the gospel. And that occupies the main part of the letter. Why do you do it? Well, he's got no guarantees on the future. To say his future was uncertain at that point is an understatement. As I said, he's hardly left Corinth when there was a plot against his life that caused him to take a detour. When he gets to Jerusalem, the number of times he was nearly killed. But although he doesn't know the future, he does know that a lot of people want him dead. He has no guarantees at all. He doesn't know whether he'll ever reach Rome. A little later, the Lord will tell him, "If you bore testimony or witness at Jerusalem, so you will bear witness at Rome." But he hasn't had that promise yet, so he's not sure. So he's going to play safe. His normal procedure: establish a church, see people converted, establish a church, and bury himself in that church for months on end as he gives them detailed, systematic instruction in the faith. 18 months at Corinth, 2 years at Ephesus. But he's never been to Rome. Now, the Christians of Rome are no fools. There are many Christians in Rome.